Time for us to begin. Glad you're here. So open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 12 as we study the life of Christ, talking about the context in which Jesus on the Sabbath day, he and his disciples had gone through a field of grain and they had picked the grain heads upon the Sabbath, and the Jews and the Pharisees accused them of violating the law on the Sabbath. We took a look at the six arguments that Jesus made in Matthew chapter 12 and Mark chapter 3. Regarding their accusation, it all kind of comes down to the fact that really when Jesus said in Matthew chapter 12 and verse 8, "For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath," the fact is that they were the ones who believed they decided the rules for the Sabbath day. Indeed, as we studied, God had made the Sabbath for man. God and his Son, Jesus, was Lord of the Sabbath. And not that he had violated the Sabbath, he or his disciples in doing so, but he pointed out their hypocrisy, their inconsistencies, and the misapplications they had made in that context. So we're going to continue from Matthew chapter 12, talking about something else that took place upon the Sabbath day, beginning in verse 9. So again, for those who are visiting tonight, we're in Matthew chapter 12. We're studying the life of Christ, and we're early in his ministry, and again, as we talked about, we're dealing with some events that took place upon the Sabbath day and the Jews' reaction to that. So if I can get someone to read Matthew chapter 12, verses 9 through verse 14 at this point in time. Matthew 9, 12 through 14. Carolyn, thank you.
Departing from there, he went into their synagogue, and a man was there whose hand was withered. And they questioned Jesus, asking, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" So that they might accuse him. And he said to them, "What man is there among you who has a sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will he not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable then is a man than a sheep? So then, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." Then he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and it was restored to normal, like the other. But the Pharisees went out and conspired against him as to how they might destroy him.
You ever studied the scriptures with anybody who was not consistent in the way they applied the scriptures? This was not consistent in the way, again, they made the application of the scriptures. We see Jesus, again, trying to, as it were, establish some consistency with those with whom he is interacting with at this point in time. We see here that, again, he is in their synagogue, and he sees there a man, he says, with a withered hand. Now, from what I understand, I don't know exactly what the medical terminology for that is, but it literally means it was dried up, you know, so whether it was just atrophy or something, I don't know exactly what the technical medical definition of that was, but he had a withered hand. It was dried up. It was unusable. And the Pharisees and the rulers of the Jews, again, seeing this man with a withered hand, again, they beheld him. They saw him. They saw the same man. And they asked of Jesus a question. And their question is a simple one. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Is it lawful to heal? Now, what are they truly asking? For what purpose are they asking this question? Why would they be asking, why is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Is their motive, number one, to, you know, are they really concerned about pleasing God? Is it where? I'm sorry?
Trying to catch him breaking the law that they have.
Right. So they have established their own, again, 39 times 39 rules about what to do on the Sabbath. And so, again, we've studied with people, haven't we, in terms of, well, what does the Bible say about this or about that? And, again, if they're good and honest, we can sit down with them, and they really want to know, what does God's Word say, or how can I please God? But when they ask, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath, they're not asking, again, for the purpose of we want to know how we can please God. We want to know what His will is. Again, as Carolyn pointed out, their question is so that they can accuse him. And is this going to be the only time that they're going to ask questions for the purpose of accusing him? No. They're going to try and catch him. They're going to try and trick him. They, again, already have perceived him as a threat to who they are. But they're not asking to try and find out how to please God. They want to accuse him. And again, we read then in verse 11, what is Jesus' response? Again, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? He has a question. You know, again, Jesus does this a lot. They ask him a question. He returns the question to them. And his question to them was, if you have
a sheep,
could be any animal, right? And it, what?
Or you can pull it out of the pit.
Falls into a pit, it's in danger. Again, your farm animal, whatever, sheep, falls into a pit. It's in danger. Are you going to rescue it on the Sabbath day? Is this a debatable question? What would they do? They would rescue that. And Jesus knew that. So again, he understands what they would do. But he says in there, what man among you shall have one sheep, and when it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will he not take hold of it, lift it out? What's his point then in verse 12? It's lawful to do so, but they're arguing, you know, he's making the point from the perspective of your sheep. Who's Jesus trying to rescue from a pit?
A man.
A man, and is there a distinction? Again, I hate to bring this up, but is there a difference between man and animals?
Yes.
Yes, there is. And Jesus phrases this distinction in terms of using the word valuable. Again, Jesus' argument then is, again, would you rescue an animal who fell into a pit on the Sabbath? Of course they would. Again, who then is more valuable, a man or that animal? And of course, the human being. And if I can get somebody to read Matthew 6 and verse 26, because Jesus makes this point in other contexts. Matthew 6, 26, well, this is actually part of the next lesson. If I can get somebody to read that verse. David?
Look at the birds of the air, that they do not sow, nor reap nor gather into barns. Yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not worth more than they?
Again, Jesus makes the point in terms of, again, comparing man to the beast or the birds of the air. Are you not more valuable than they are? Are you not worth much more? And again, Matthew chapter 10 and verse 31. If I guess I better read that verse. Matthew 10 and verse 31. Mickey?
Verse 31. Fear not, therefore. Ye are of more value than many sparrows.
So again, Jesus, on more than one occasion, makes the point that, again, man is more valuable than the birds, of which, and the animals, and the things that God created that you would take care of, but you're condemning someone who would heal a man on the Sabbath. What is it that makes man indeed more valuable than a sheep or the birds of the air? A soul. Who did God create in His own image? He created man in His own image. Did He create the sheep or the oxen or the birds or the fish in His own image? Is that to say they don't have an important place, that we're not to take care of them? No, that's not the question. The question is only one thing that God created, He created in His image. And that's man, who He gave the eternal soul to.
You think there's a point to be made on the expression 1 in verse 11? What man shall there be of you that shall have one sheep and it fall into the pit on the Sabbath day? Will he not lay hold on and lift it up? How much then is a man of more value than a sheep? If a man only had one, he would trick.
Yeah.
Much like the illustration that we're talking about.
Yeah, the one little ewe lamb. Yeah. But again, I really hadn't paid attention to that, Mick, but that's a good point. Again, that they're talking about just your one lamb, your one sheep. You would do what you need to. But again, how much more valuable is a man than an animal? Of course, the human being is. He has the soul, an eternal being that God created in his own image. So, Jesus then does what? After explaining this, he heals the man. He heals the man's hand. And the Pharisees' response? Yeah, it's interesting. It says, verse 13, they said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and it was restored to normal like the other. And the Pharisees went out and counseled together against him as to how they might destroy him. So again, they're not, at this point in time, actually trying to lay hands on him. But what are they doing?
Plotting.
And looking up this word, again, they conspired, or New King James says, plotted as to how they might destroy him. And when you look up that Greek word that's used for plotted or conspired, it kind of refers to the idea of pulling together a committee, you know, to form a plan. And it made me think about how our politicians today talk about, we're going to form an investigative committee to look into how to address something. It's kind of what the Pharisees said. We're going to put the best minds together here. We're going to form a group, and we're going to look into it to develop a plan on how we can destroy him.
Two other things stand out. One is that they know that he could heal because they're asking him a question about that. And then after he heals him, there's no mention that they're like, wow, you just healed that guy. Not at all. So they don't even care about the fact that this is a miraculous act.
But do you remember in Acts chapter 5? Again, when Peter and John are brought before the rulers, and what did they admit regarding what Peter and John had done? A noteworthy miracle has taken place, and they said, We can't deny it. Again, did they? You're right. They didn't. They weren't impressed by it. They didn't see the sign. They didn't try to deny it. They just tried to, again, they're focused on the legality of the fact that you did a miracle on the Sabbath. I mean, it baffles the mind, doesn't it? To give somebody with, again, a withered hand, Jesus says, hold it out, and instantly it's healed, and they're like, we're going to kill him. But can man become so hard-hearted today, just as they were? Can it happen to us? Can we become so blind to the truth that, again, even when presented with the facts and with scriptural evidence, that we don't care? And so we marvel at the fact that these Pharisees could just, as Pharaoh points out, see a miracle, and all they could think about is, let's kill him. But again, Satan can harden anybody's heart to that extent.
They use the word fascinated, I'm sure. It fascinates me when I parallel some accounts of the reaction of the Jews to Jesus' teaching and to his miracles. In Matthew 13th chapter, we see a quotation from the Old Testament about how that God had blinded their eyes and hardened their heart and so forth. But in John's account, he uses just a little bit different terminology in verse 30. In Matthew's account, they did not believe. They stated as a fact. But in John's account, it says, in verse 39, well, this caused...
Chapter what?
Could not believe. John 12. Okay. Well, this caused they could not believe. For that Isaiah said again, he has blinded their eyes, hardened their heart, lest they should see with their eyes, perceive with their heart, and should turn again, and I should heal. When we look at that expression, it takes on a whole added significance.
Well, then again, the question becomes, how is it that they couldn't?
Didn't want to.
And any time, again, that again we see this, perhaps, when time after time you keep making the same decision, you, as we're using the expression, you double down on the decision made before, and again and again and again, again, you get to that point where you've committed yourself, and you can't now flee. You've committed yourself to the lie. So that's where we're at. Again, it is fascinating. They saw a miracle performed. And again, all they can think about is we need to kill him. We're going to put together a committee. We're going to form a group. We're going to figure out how to take him down. He's a threat to us. Did they actually say those words to Jesus in Matthew chapter 12? Did they actually say to Jesus, we're going to get you? No, but Jesus, what?
He knew their hearts.
In verse 15, Jesus, aware of this, withdrew from them, and many followed him, and he healed them all. So he knew their hearts. We've talked about that from John chapter 2, verse 25 before. Again, Jesus knows the hearts of them. And Jesus knows our heart as well. He doesn't have to be told what they're thinking. In John chapter 2, verse 25, because he did not need anyone to bear witness concerning man, for he himself knew what was in man. While he walked upon the face of the earth, he knew their hearts. Jesus knows our hearts today. And it says there, going back to Matthew chapter 12, there in verse 15, again, he withdrew from there, and many followed him, and he healed them all. So again, we talk about the fact, and we've mentioned before, how the miracles that he performed created large multitudes that followed him around. But what did those multitudes sometimes hinder him from being able to do? To teach and to preach like he wanted to do. That's what he came to do, Mark chapter 1, verse 38. But again, he withdrew from there, and we talk about the fact that the confrontations between the Pharisees and the Jews and Jesus have already begun. We have already studied how to begin. The persecution has already begun. But is it Jesus' time yet to lay down his life? No, it's not. He's got work to do. And so it's not time to, again, for the final confrontation, as it were. And he withdraws from there. But as he withdraws, he doesn't withdraw alone, and many follow him. And many follow him seeking the miraculous healings that they have seen of him, his ability, his divine ability to do. And we read there in verse 15 that he healed them all. But interestingly enough, what does verse 16 tell us about Jesus and the instructions that he gave to those who he healed? I've always found this fascinating. That how many times Jesus would miraculously heal somebody. We've already studied this. How he would heal them and then tell them, don't tell anyone. Don't tell anyone what I have done for you. Why would he give such instructions? I'm sorry? It's not time yet?
He wasn't sent to heal. He was sent to teach. I think it's said about the apostles more than that. But the fact of the matter is that when he healed someone to show that he was indeed authorized to say the things that he was saying, it was not that which he was trying to emphasize, but rather the words that he was trying to teach.
And the truth is, if Jesus had opened up a clinic, as it were, to heal all who were infirmed, would that have taken up all his time? He could have spent his whole time here upon earth, again, healing people. Did he heal people? Did he have compassion on their physical ailments? Yes. But is that what he came here for? No.
I'll host a minute. In Matthew, the fourth chapter, we've already talked about. Verse 23, Jesus went about in all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing all manner of disease, all manner of sickness among people. The report of him went into all Syria. They brought unto him all that were sick, old, divers, diseases, torments, possessed with demons, and epileptic, and palsy, and he healed them. And there followed him great multitudes from Galilee, Decapolis, and Jerusalem, and Judea, and beyond the Jordan. You put that all on the map, and you've got the whole area of Palestine that's been bringing people to be healed, and he healed them all.
In John chapter 21, what are we told about the miracles that Jesus performed? That if you wrote a story, and every one of these who was healed by Jesus, is there a story with everyone in terms of how they got to where they were and the infirmities that they had? You could write a story for every one of them. In John chapter 21, what did John say about if you wrote a story about every miracle he performed?
The world could not hold this.
You couldn't carry around that book. And indeed, there are again countless miracles that Jesus performed. Again, and so many people with so many needs all throughout that came to him. And indeed, we read again here in Matthew chapter 12 that he healed them all. But again, that's not why he came here. He didn't come to relieve physical ailments and the physical suffering the man had, though he took opportunities where he could to do so. Again, one of the reasons we keep going back to in terms of why he would tell some individuals, don't tell anybody. And again, obviously the word was out, wasn't it? But why tell anybody, don't tell anybody? Well, in John chapter 7 and in verse 8, we read there Jesus telling his disciples, go up to the feast yourselves. I do not go up to this feast because my time has not fully come. As we look at Jesus at this point in his life upon earth, his time has not fully come. Again, he has work to do. He has teaching to accomplish. And as we're going to study here in just a moment, he's got 12 men that he's about to call to himself. And he's got work to do with those 12 men. And it's some very important work. And so again, I think a lot of why he's warned people, again, not to tell who he was, had to do with the fact that his time had not fully come. Now, going back to Matthew chapter 12, if I can get somebody to read verse 15 through 21, we've kind of referred to verse 15 already, but let's set the context. Matthew 12, 15 through 21. Jim?
Jesus, aware of this, withdrew from there, and many followed him, and he healed them all, and ordered them not to make him known. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. Behold, my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved, with whom my soul is well pleased. I will put my spirit upon him, and he will proclaim justice to the Gentiles. He will not quarrel or cry aloud, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not quench, until he brings justice to victory, and in his name the Gentiles will hope.
All right, so we talked about this already, that again, Jesus says, don't tell anybody. What does Matthew have to say about this, about Jesus' instruction about not to tell anyone? Matthew says what? This is to
fulfill prophecy.
This is to fulfill prophecy. So when we talk about Jesus, telling, this man to not go tell anybody, there was a practical reason. There was also a prophetic reason. And Matthew says there's a prophecy that was fulfilled by Jesus doing this. And that prophecy comes from Isaiah chapter 42, verses 1 through 3. And again, I'm not going to go and read that context. Those are the verses where that comes from. And Matthew, again, quotes that. Again, there's some translation between the Septuagint and between the original Hebrew language. But we read there again, what he quotes from Isaiah 42 is that, my servant whom I've chosen, my beloved, in whom my soul is well pleased, I will put my spirit within him, and he shall proclaim justice to the Gentiles. He will not quarrel, nor cry out, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. And we'll talk about the last part. But the question is that how does this passage in Isaiah chapter 42 fulfill the fact that, or how does what Jesus did, I got that backwards, didn't I? How does what Jesus did in telling this man not to, again, go tell anybody, fulfill what we read here in Isaiah 42? Now, when I read this, and when I have read this before, it's not an obvious to me fulfillment of these verses. When I read Isaiah 42, 1 to 3, if I read that alone, I wouldn't necessarily, again, immediately jump to, oh, well, Jesus fulfilled that when he told this man not to tell anybody. Jonathan?
So, I'm supposing that it's from the part where he says, I will put my spirit upon him, and he will declare justice to the Gentiles. The fact that the Spirit of God was acting through him for the express purpose of healing all of the multitudes, but rather in the expression
anybody else have any thoughts about that? All right. Well, hold on to that. And let me just tell you where I kind of went with this. To me, as I read this, the key words I was focusing on was the part where it says, he will not quarrel nor cry out, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. Was Jesus' purpose in coming to earth to engage in debates and battles throughout his whole ministry? Was he here to antagonize and to, again, create as were battles in the street over what's, you know, what's true and what's not? No. What did he come to do? He came to preach, to offer his teaching, to offer the will of God. What was the effect of those who proclaimed Jesus' miracles on his opposition? What did those who talked about his miracles, how did that affect his opposition?
It irritated them.
It riled them up. And the more people talked about his miracles, the more it incited them, didn't it? And it riled them up. And so where I'm going with this is I see this as the purpose of this prophecy is that Jesus told this man not to go tell anybody because he wasn't in the business of, again, trying to have confrontations with the Pharisees as he went about proclaiming the gospel. But he had preaching to do. He had teaching to do.
I was going to say this, sir. The whole thing just reminds me of, I came not to send peace but to bring sword. And that's exactly what he did. I mean, he's not running around through the streets whacking away at people. But his words bring a sword against these people.
Right. Yeah. And he wasn't there and much to the chagrin, perhaps even of his own apostles, his disciples, he wasn't there to engage in physical battles, you know, to force people. But again, to be that prophet, again, who spoke the words of truth without shouting in the streets, without quarreling, without crying out, but his voice was heard. Carolyn? David, and then David.
Let's see, you were on verse 19. Are you about to go to verse 20?
Yes, I have, but go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No. David?
I was thinking, too, that verse kind of goes along with the fact that he's the servant. He's not here to be, he wasn't here to, shout in the streets.
Today you hear a lot about servant leadership. Jesus lived that before it was even a concept. David?
I kind of thought about that word that you said, that you used, that Jesus didn't go around debating with people. I can't think of any word in the Bible were supposed to know and corrected them what the scriptures truly said. And to me, that was like, you know, sticking the dagger in and then turning it a little bit. And he did that in front of other people, not just the scribes and Pharisees.
Right. Right. No, as we talk about Jesus, you've heard the expression was he's the master teacher. Yeah. And his use, as he does here, in terms of using his questioning, he would often, again, get a question and respond with a question, not debate them, but again, to put it back on them. You know, I think about Matthew 21, in terms of, again, remember when they came to him about John the Baptist. And again, he left without, again, and he simply, again, you know, John the Baptist of heaven or of men. And they couldn't answer that. Did he teach? Yeah. Did he argue with them? No. Did he yell in the streets about, no? Bruce and then Jimmy?
You know, continually show his divine authority to everything.
Yeah.
It's not with the argument.
Well, we're in lesson six, and we get into the Sermon on the Mount. We're simply going to see his divine authority as Jesus, again, and they observed his divine authority, didn't they? They had never seen somebody preach and teach with such authority.
Okay. Well, along these lines, where it's talking about he doesn't cry aloud, nobody hears his voice in the street, he wasn't the kind of person to call attention to himself. He didn't stand in the middle of a crowd and say, hey, I have something to say, just to have people come to him. He started his conversations with individuals, and they brought other people to him. He had a magnetic personality and a magnetic message. People were drawn to him, but he did not call attention to himself.
He didn't demand again. You know, either through volume or through, you know, any other means that people come to him. You think about, the Lord's invitation, Matthew chapter 11. You know, what a gentle invitation that was. You know, all who are worried, heavy laden, I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me. It wasn't, again, a demand, a scream, a shout, but a humble appeal that if you want to learn the truth, again, if you want to take my yoke upon you, I will gladly lead you. So yeah, very, very humble approach that he took in terms of leading. Now, Carolyn, was it you who said about the next part of that verse? It is very interesting. Again, in that next part, he says, a battered reed he will not break off, a smoldering wick he will not put out until he leads justice to victory. When we talk about, again, who did Jesus say as the great physician that he came for?
The sick.
He came to those who had the needs. Did he come for the rulers of the Jews? He came to seek and to save all who were lost. But he came to seek and to save those who recognized they were lost. He came to seek and to save those who were downtrodden. He came to seek and to save those who recognize their spiritual needs. And to those who have those spiritual needs, those are the ones, as Jenny, you were talking about, who would come to him. And Jesus had that ability. For those who were looked down upon, the downcast, the ones who were the outcasts of Jewish society, did they feel comfortable with Jesus? Yes. They would come to him, and he would teach them. And those were the ones. Did he have to, quote, shout and debate with those people? No, because they had an appetite for the truth. And again, I think, again, this aspect of the battered reed he will not break off, the smoldering wick he will not put out until it leads justice to victory. He came to those who realized that they needed saving, who realized that they were, as in Luke chapter 18, in the parable of the Pharisee and the publican, as a publican prayed, be merciful to me, the sinner. Carolyn?
I have another thought.
Okay.
Not studied this passage in detail before, so I'm thinking out loud here. Partway through that it says, until he leads justice to victory, which implies that at that time the battered reed would be broken off, the smoldering wick would be put out. I was thinking perhaps it meant whatever's left of Judaism far gone from what it's supposed to be, and he didn't smash it. It kept on going, and he didn't put it out, but then the part, until he leads justice to victory, when he conquers death through the resurrection, that's when, okay, now the Jewish nation, this whole system is done, even though they tried to keep practicing it, but that's when it was, he conquered over. So I don't know, but I...
Okay.
That's just the first five.
Well, certainly that aspect of leading justice to victory, I think you're absolutely right. That's him and his death upon the cross, his burial, his resurrection, again, raised to the right hand of God. Again, that's when, again, he achieved victory for us all. But he achieved victory for those who realized that they had spiritual needs, those who came to him in meekness and humility, who realized that they were downtrodden, who realized that, again, they were spiritually afflicted and they needed him, who benefited from his victory. It was those who recognized and understood their undone condition. Again, peeking ahead to Matthew chapter 5, where we'll be in a couple weeks when we get there. Again, where the Beatitude starts with blessed are the, what's the first Beatitude?
Poor in spirit.
Poor in spirit, yes. And I believe, we'll talk about it when we get there. I believe there's a, well, there's always a purpose to Jesus' teaching. I believe Jesus started with that Beatitude for a reason. Because how foundational it is in terms of, can anybody, again, benefit from the victory of Jesus Christ over sin and death if we don't realize how poor in spirit we are and don't realize how much that we need him? You know, but certainly when he did that, he overcame the whole Jewish, you know, system of law. Again, he nailed the law to the cross as he did that. Any other thoughts then? Certainly, again, as Jonathan pointed out, you can't not take note of the fact that once again, Jesus has, Matthew, in quoting the scripture, applying it to Jesus, points to the fact that who is going to be a part of the Lord's kingdom?
Gentiles.
The Gentiles are. And again, part of what Jesus, why Jesus came, why he led justice to victory, was the fact that it was not just going to be the Jews who would benefit from this victory, but indeed, and in his name, the Gentiles will have hope. His efforts to, again, to preach and to teach, not just, again, to do miracles, but it was for the purpose of, again, healing those who recognize their own spiritual condition. But it's also for the purpose then to recognize there are those who are not Jews, who are the Gentiles, who will benefit from his victory as well.
I'm just going to point out that there in Matthew 12:15, the sentence says, but Jesus, aware of this, withdrew from there. Then he followed him and he healed them all and warned them not to tell who he was. And then verse 17, the first two words says, this was, to fulfill what was spoken. This was is in italics, which tells me that those words were really there. I mean, the translation put it there. But if you read it without that, it says, warn them to tell, not to tell who he was, to fulfill what was spoken to Isaiah the prophet. I guess my point is that it seems like the fulfillment of what was spoken through Isaiah the prophet is the whole sentence and not just the second half of it. Many followed him and healed them all.
Oh, okay.
Is that?
Yeah.
So it's making reference to the whole sentence.
Okay.
And not just the warning.
Okay, good. Good. All right, any other thoughts then about this healing of the withered man and this prophecy? We're going to go into, again, the final portion of lesson 6 here in the life of Christ. And that's the selection of the 12 apostles. So we're actually in Matthew going to go backwards to Matthew chapter 10. If I can get somebody to read then verses 1 through 4, Matthew 10. Actually, I forgot. I wanted to use the Mark context, Mark 3, 13 through 19. I just wanted to hear the pages flip a little bit more. Mark 3, 13 through 19. Anybody? Lisa?
Mark 3, 13 through 19. And he went up to the mountain and summoned those whom he himself wanted, and they came to him. And he appointed 12 that they might be with him, and that he might send them out to preach and to have authority to cast out the demons. And he appointed the 12, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, and James the son of Zebedee, and John the brother of James. To them he gave the names. Which means sons of thunder, to Andrew and Philip and Bartholomew and Matthew and Thomas and James the son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus and Simon the Zealot and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him.
All right, so we read here that he went up to the mountain and some of those whom he himself wanted, and they came to him. I also want to go to Luke chapter 6. There's a point in Luke's account of this that I want to point out also. So Luke chapter 6, verses 12 through 16. Anybody can read that for us. Randy?
Luke 6, 12 through 16. It was at this time that he went off to the mountain to pray, and he spent the whole night in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples to him and chose 12 of them, whom he also named his apostles: Simon, whom he also named Peter, and Andrew and his brother, and James and John, and Philip and Bartholomew, and Matthew and Thomas, James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon who was called the Zealot, Judas the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor.
So what preceded Jesus' selection of these 12 men?
Prayer.
Just a quick prayer? No, it says it's been all night. He went off to a mountain to pray all night. Again, we read in Mark chapter 1, you remember, about how that Jesus there when he was in Capernaum, and the whole town had come to him, how that he got up early in the morning and went off by himself to pray. And again, we see before he is going to select these 12 men for a very special purpose, he realizes the need to go to God in prayer. And to pray earnestly about this, to pray all night. I remember this verse about Jesus praying all night. I fail to remember the fact that this is what preceded his selection of the 12 apostles. That again, if we are facing major decisions in life about what we're going to do and where we're going to go, and again, major life decisions, praying and praying hard and praying long, praying intensely, Jesus modeled that for us here. And we read then in Mark chapter 3, as we did, that he determined those who he wanted. And that word wanted literally means determined, resolved, chosen, and preferred. And after he had prayed all night, it was Jesus, knowing the hearts of all men, who resolved in his heart, these are the 12 men that I need with me. These are the 12 men who I have some very special purposes for. And he then called these 12 to himself. Again, that same word called used in Acts chapter 2 and verse 39. And how is it used in Acts chapter 2 and verse 39? And that's the word that's used here by Matthew to describe what Jesus did in regards to these 12 apostles. What was the purpose for these chosen 12, as stated in these texts that we read? Well, number one, we read simply in Mark chapter 3, so that they would be with him. When we talk about the qualifications of an apostle, what do they need to do? They need to be with him. They needed to listen to him. They needed to hear him, watch him, observe him. That's what made an apostle an apostle. He chose these men to be with him, to be his, those who would accompany him wherever he went. And we read in Acts chapter 1 and verse 22 about the qualifications of what an apostle is. They needed to be with him. And specifically it says there, and I'm not going to be able to quote that. It's just not coming to me right now. Verse 21, is therefore necessary that of the men who have accompanied us all the time that the Lord Jesus went in and out among us, beginning with the baptism of John until the day that he was taken up from us, one of these should become a witness with us of his resurrection. So from that context, in terms of that they would be with him, had these 12 already been with him? What did Luke in Acts chapter 1 say was the beginning point? Baptism by John, which has already taken place. So we're talking about men, and again, I'm sure there were many others that had been with Jesus now from the time that he was baptized. But of those who had been with him, he chose these, though they had been with him, to be with him and to remain with him. Number two, he chose these men to be with him, but so that he could send them out. They were going to be with him for a while. And again, send out is from the Greek word apostello, which is where we get the word apostles. So he could send them out to preach, and literally means to be a herald. And number three, first of all, Luke chapter 6 and verse 13 talks about the fact that he also named as apostles. So that's where we get the word. That's the title that Jesus divinely gave them as apostles. One set apart and sent forth. And we know that we quote that definition, but we talk about one sent forth, but also, again, the fact that they were set apart for this purpose. And number three, he chose them to have authority. And interestingly enough, you remember several weeks ago we talked about in the scriptures, two different words, Greek words, are used for authority. Anybody remember what those two Greek words are? One's the word for dynamite, dunamis, which means power, might, strength. The other one is exousia is the way I say it, which means right to rule, authority. Any idea which one's used here? When he says to have us, it's exousia. He gave them authority. Authority even over demons to cast them out. And so, real quick, next week, we will talk about the 12. We'll talk about each of the 12 apostles real quick. And then we're going to wrap up lesson number 6. There are copies of the questions. I would anticipate, Lord willing, next Wednesday night, we'll begin those questions. So if you want to pick up a copy up there. But again, thank you for your time tonight, and appreciated the discussion, and we'll look forward to finishing this next Wednesday.